Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Gies, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Greetings, everybody. We are back live again this week. Welcome to another episode of the Voice of Indie podcast. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and this is episode number 123. And with me is my co-host, Stephen Gies. How you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing great. You're doing all right?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm well rested and ready to go.
So we're back live again after doing a rerun last week of the Jerry Pate, Robert G. Williscroft Submariner episode. I hope everybody who missed it the first time caught a chance to do that. As we had mentioned before, we were in Nashville at the Ryman Auditorium seeing Jason Bonham, the son of the late Led Zeppelin drummer John Bonham, and his own band doing all Led Zeppelin music. So we had a good old time. Now everybody's gearing up for the holidays. I can tell because my father went out and strung Christmas lights and a Christmas tree on the boathouse, which looks very cool. Looks very cool at night because it reflects on all the water all around it and ripples and twinkles because of the little waves and ripples in the water and stuff. So we know it's Christmas around here when the boathouses start lighting up. But we want to let everybody know that Mad Max and Sweet Sarah, the audio book, is out now, and that's narrated by movie star Ethan Drew, who's soon going to be starring in a movie with Christopher Lloyd. And that is out. You can go to Audible, ACX, or Amazon and order your copy right now. It's not very expensive. It's very cool, and it's especially geared toward teenagers, especially teenage girls. So if you know anybody, what a Christmas present that would make.
Yes, indeed. It's a fun audio book there. Operation Whiteout by Robert G. Williscroft. The audio version of that is in progress. In fact, I spent this whole afternoon working on that and knocked out two chapters on that, and I'll jump right back into it again tomorrow and get this thing done as soon as possible. So keep an eye out for that. And over on Twitter, Ver Wayne Greenho, he's got a little update on his Vela project, and he says, I uploaded episode 26 of my Vela, I Hate My Mother, a true story of the abuse I endured as a boy and the stupid things I did later. It
sounds
should
like
be
a
live
feel,
tonight.
Feel good piece, huh?
Yeah, feel good piece. Well, there you go, Verwayne. Get over there to, if you don't know, have the link, you can come over here on Twitter and just use hashtag Fresh Ink Group. And once you get to that feed, click on latest, and he's right up there, Verwayne Greenho, talking about his Vela project. So get over there and do that. And if you want to know how to be part of this show, you want to experience the conversations with our guests, you can do it like Verwayne did there on Twitter using the hashtag, or you can call in. And here's how you can do all of that.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest, or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Now, Larry Jorgensen's book, Shipwrecked and Rescued, Cars and Crew, The City of Bangor, is out now in dust jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all of the different ebook editions worldwide. That's a book that Larry originally self-published, and then he brought it to Fresh Ink Group when it turned out it was going to be a hit. So we republished it, put it into worldwide distribution. Thing's selling like gangbusters. It's 102 pages, and he's selling it at $20 for a softcover and $30 for a hardcover, and selling them as fast as he can. It's in our top two bestsellers at Fresh Ink Group and has been for weeks now. And Larry's selling them directly through his own website and his own connections, and he's been ordering from us 200 copies at a time every week or two. And every time it's like, I'm almost out, how quick can you get them to me? So They're really moving well. He's also shopping those around at car collector conventions and people who are into naval stuff and things like that. Anytime he can find a group gathering, he goes and shows them the book, winds up selling a bunch. So he's out there working it hard. Congratulations, journalist and historian Larry Jorgensen on Shipwrecked and Rescued. Everybody needs to get over and check out the video we made for it on YouTube as well.
Yeah, cool video. And How to Teach Driving, Instructor's Edition by Kenneth Lindquist is out now. So you can go over to Amazon and grab a copy. The How to Teach Driving Parents Edition is going to be dropping any day now. So keep your ears open for that. And if you want to know when these books are going to drop and what we've got coming up in the future with other Freshing Group projects and other people that aren't even attached to Freshing Group, we promote them in our newsletter. So you want to know how to get that newsletter? Here's how you can subscribe.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter. New releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
All right, now it's time to take a look at what our top five print bestsellers are from Fresh Ink Group in this past week or so. And I want to point out something about these lists. I've been reading these lists for 6 months now, something like that. And I keep being surprised. I think we're all being surprised at how well the hardcovers are doing of many of these titles. Quite often, both the softcover and the hardcover are in the top five, often with the hardcover outselling the soft. And that's speaking a lot because, you know, 5 years ago, hardcovers seemed like, you know, just an afterthought. You sell 100 softcovers and a couple of hardcovers, and our authors were mainly interested in having them, you know, just available in case someone wanted one or wanted a nice collector's copy, but to have sitting on the table at book signings and events and things like that, because they look nice. They look prestigious. But now they're turning into a major revenue stream. So let's look at the top five. Cash crop. There you go. When I pasted this list on the rundown yesterday, we had the same book in the top two slots, meaning the hardcover and the softcover are selling almost equally as well. And that's The High Road, Memories from a Long Trip by Mark Herndon. You regular listeners know a couple of weeks ago we announced that Mark Herndon has been selected to be inducted into the North Carolina Music Hall of Fame, not country music, just Music Hall of Fame for North Carolina, and he's going to be awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award, and they're going to hold a ceremony in Myrtle Beach at the House of Blues in late January. Any of you are interested in the details?
I don't need to read that because that was what I was supposed to read next. So I'm going to cross that off my list.
All right. You go ahead and do that. The Shipwrecked and Rescued is in the 3 and 4 slots. Both the hardcover and the softcover are selling very well. Now, I'm looking at it right now, and it has updated. Shipwrecked and Rescued hardcover has moved up to number 2 and pushed the softcover of The High Road down a slot. High Road, Memories from a Long Trip, Shipwrecked and Rescued, The City of Bangor, both of those are in the top 4 slots, both hardcover and softcover. And then in the 5th slot, Submariner, 30 Years of Hijinks and Keeping the Fleet Afloat. And I want to mention to you that Jerry Pate, the author of that book, just stocked up on a lot more dust jacketed hardcovers. This is a very thick book, 60 chapters of stories from the guy who was commander of a nuclear submarine and, you know, was involved in the space shuttle recovery and a whole lot of other very cool missions. He's got great stories to tell.
Great
now, these
story.
Hardcovers, he's got a whole bunch of them sitting there. So they are moving out steadily, but we've decided that we're going to offer through merch.freshinkgroup.com. We don't have it up there yet. Give us a day or two to get everything set up. But he's going to offer autographed copies of the hardcover edition. And if you read the book, you'll see he suffered a brain injury, and sometimes things are a bit of a struggle for him. So for him to autograph these books is a big deal. For the most part, he's been selling lots of them but not autographing them. And if you'd really like to have an autographed hardcover, then give us a day or two, and you can check that out, and then Jerry will send that to you directly himself. It's a very thick book, so it's $36.95 on Amazon, but he's going to let it go for $40, including the shipping and the autograph, and I can't wait to get my copy of that.
Yeah, that is an excellent book. Those stories are just amazing, and they're all true. Well, except for one. We just don't know which one that is. As Stephen mentioned about Mark Herndon, is about to receive the Lifetime Achievement Award and his induction into the South Carolina Music Hall of Fame. Well, on December 28th, since this is between Christmas and New Year, we are rerunning the episode with Mark and his wife, Leah Seawright. So she's a country music singer, and Mark's playing drums for her these days. So be sure to tune in for that one if you've missed it the first time around or you just want to hear it again, because it's a really cool episode, and we had a lot of fun that night. So speaking of really cool episodes and missing and just wanting to hear another one, or you're new to the show and, hey, you haven't heard them all yet, so you want to check them out, we have an archive that is growing by the week, because we are now up to 123 of these shows, and, you know, I just started scheduling shows for January, so, and we've got one scheduled already for February, so here's how you can find our archive.
Find your favorite show in the Voice of Indy archives on YouTube at Fresh Ink Group, StephenGees.com, BeamWeeks.com, FreshInkGroup.com, and on Spotify. And now, you can listen on iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn. Just search The Voice of Indy, all one word.
All right, so let's meet this week's guest. Tom Stewart is a memoirist and novelist. He was born in 1982 and grew up near Winnipeg, Canada. He attended the University of Manitoba, studying literature and philosophy, then worked in the North as a fishing and hunting guide, an oil rig roughneck, a bush pilot, and he backpacked internationally in the off season. So apparently he's a slacker who likes to sit around and watch TV. Tom now lives in Tofino, Vancouver Island. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Welcome, Tom.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
So, usually the question is, where are you from? Where have you lived? And so on and so forth. Where did you backpack internationally?
Where did I backpack internationally? My first time that I went, I was 17 and went to Australia, which was just eye-opening, being by myself in a foreign country, and went down there and ended up running out of money and not too much time. So I had to pick pears at a pear farm. So didn't see that one coming. But I just always had so much luck traveling. I ended up meeting such interesting people and learned so much. And that was sort of the first inaugural event of my traveling that I did, more into Europe and some into South America. So I always enjoyed it.
Cool. Interesting story, picking pears.
Yeah. So over on Twitter, we've got a couple of posts. Joe Condrell has joined in. He says he's looking forward to tonight's guest, Tom Stewart. And then Verwayne Greenhoe posted a link to the video for Shipwrecked and Rescued, Larry Jorgensen's book. So if you're having trouble finding it, head over to Twitter and click on that link, and you can check that book out. So, Tom, what kind of kid were you growing up in Canada? Were you into reading and writing from an early age, or building snowmen, or how do you keep busy up there when you're a kid?
I'd say I have a appreciation for words that started pretty early. I'd credit my mom for that, for reading to us at a young age, my brother and my sister and I. I was always an outdoor kid, so I was always into fishing and just playing outside with the other kids and going to the lake. And so I'm more so outdoors, and I wasn't too big into school. I didn't get very good grades. And that didn't really change until my first year of university, when that was very different, when you can pick your own courses. And you can pick up what interests you. So there was a really big difference between early school and later on in university. But as a kid, I loved the outdoors. And I had such an ideal upbringing that I could walk down at the end of my street and go fishing, try to catch catfish in the Red River. And we had sort of a nice acre lot, so we could play outside with the other neighborhood kids. And I was really lucky in that regard.
Oh, nice. Now, every guy that I knew up who grew up in Canada played hockey at some point. Were you ever a hockey player or into any other sports?
Yeah, the stereotype rings true. So I was learning to skate at about the same time I was starting to walk, probably without much exaggeration, because I remember when the Red River would freeze over, this major river that was right beside us, that we would be pushing ice crates on the ice while learning to skate, so we could, you know, barely stand on two legs. But here we are on the river trying to push these things along on the frozen water. And so, yeah, I got to start early, and then played hockey for probably the next 10 years or so, and then would always still play. Even when I stopped playing on a team, we'd still play on the outdoor ices and try to ring the puck off the posts and just pick up games here and there. But, yeah, the cliche is definitely true with Canadians in hockey.
Cool. Now, as mentioned, you attended University of Manitoba, and you studied literature and philosophy. Have these courses come in handy, you know, now that you're a writer, you know, authoring?
They definitely have, because I didn't have any exposure to philosophy as a way to orient yourself with the world, as a way of processing ideas and forming good arguments and logical ideas. And so all that was new to me, and it's tremendously useful just trying to navigate a world of uncertainty. So that, paired with formal study of literature and hearing a prof that's passionate about his topic and a topic that she knows well, it was a sea change, really. It was so interesting. I ended up only taking 2 years because I didn't know what I would want to do with a liberal arts degree. But those 2 years were really formative for me, and I took so much away. And then I would continue just to study on my own and still read philosophical works and heavy literature. And I credit a lot of that just to how interesting the formal exchange of ideas and learning in a university environment was.
Do you have any future plans for, you know, maybe furthering your education and into a different direction, maybe, or furthering what you already know? Going back to school?
Well, I'm just such a I love education and learning so much. I'm always reading a fiction novel, but also a nonfiction book. And then there's so many interesting podcasts out there. So I just have a love of knowledge that I don't think I need to constrain it by being in an academic environment, even though I did love it. It would be so useful. I think I can do a lot on my own and sharing ideas with friends. And, you know, I just had two really good friends that stayed over for a few nights, and one is a professional philosopher and one is a neurologist. So I'm lucky to have such interesting, unique people in my life. But also another way to share and exchange ideas. So I'll always just be drawn to learning. It's just a passion for it, but I probably won't return to university, no.
I'm a big supporter of philosophy education myself. Most people have the impression, you know, like you take philosophy classes in university. I took a couple, and most people think you take those and it's a lot of sitting around and musing about big thoughts and, you know, what is this and what is that and everything. But you're right. It's learning logic. It's learning to recognize how to deconstruct arguments, how to support with evidence, how to find the flaws in reasoning and whatnot. And I'm finding I use that more now than I ever have in my life, because we're constantly barraged with false information, bad logic, and, you know, false arguments and things like that. And I'm always using those skills. So I think that turned out to be a terrific thing. I did it kind of as a lark and to fill out my requirements. But my philosophy classes, I think, were some of the best things I learned in university.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a real mistake that it's not in, you know, junior high or high school, when it seems like something like that is so much more practical at solving real world dilemmas and helping a person choose moral decisions. Maybe so much more useful than, you know, a lot of things are worthwhile in education, but I don't know how useful chemistry is. If something has to be swapped out, it seems like there's a great argument to have more philosophy, something really practical in early education as well.
Yeah, a lot of schools have like debate teams, and that's a good start. You know, you have to learn how to construct your arguments and, you know, support them and stuff like that, but not nearly the kind of stuff we learn in philosophy classes.
Yeah. Over on Twitter, Joe Conjol has a question for you. He says, "Hi, Tom. What got you interested in writing? And will you write another memoir, or will you continue writing novels going forward?"
I appreciate the question. Thanks for that. I always respected the craft of writing. From a pretty early age, I was reading heavier literature. I've just been drawn to literary fiction, those big ideas that concern truth and beauty and the human experience of confronting our inevitable death. So heavy work, sort of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Hemingway, I've always read them, and I admire that craft so much. I have been drawn to it and wanted to try my hand at it if I could give back or contribute to a craft I value highly. So I kind of a strange story was I ended up playing online poker for a number of years. And then when I transitioned out of that, I had some time. I could do what I wanted. And, yeah, I wanted to try my hand at writing. And so that was the first book. It was Under Big Hearted Skies. Excuse me. So that was a memoir. And I just had all these unique experiences from places that I've worked and interesting characters I met. So I wanted to put them into a collection and see if other people would enjoy reading them. And after sifting through different editors, I found one that really clicked with me, and she thought they're definitely stories worth telling and people would enjoy hearing of them. So that was sort of the first start. But I did always have my eye on trying to write very serious, very contributive for powerful literary fiction novels. And so that was my second book that came out earlier this year, Immortal North. But from here on in, to answer the second part of that question, from here on in, I would suspect for the foreseeable future, it'll be more literary fiction, more novels, because I wrote that memoir up to my early 30s and I'm 40 now. So if I did another memoir, it wouldn't be anytime soon. Need to more time for the stories to accumulate, I think.
Yeah, more living. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned online poker. My older brother, he's really into that, and he still does that quite often. But for me, when I want to lose my money, I just go to the slot machines.
Yeah, there's lots of options for how to lose the money, that's for sure.
So I think it's about time we roll a commercial, Beam.
All righty.
Let's hit our number one bestseller, almost 7 years in print now, and it's still selling like crazy.
What drives a man to spend 26 years performing night after night? To persevere through a stifling tour bus, bad food, strange women, flared tempers, a plane nearly blown from the sky? Just how did that troubled military brat with a dream claw his way from dirt floor dive bar shows to the world's biggest stages? Aviator, author, and Country Music Hall of Fame drummer Mark Herndon lived that dream playing with Alabama, one of the most popular and celebrated bands of all time. He learned some hard lessons about people and life, the music industry, the accolades and awards, how easy it is to lose it all, and how hard it is to survive, to embrace sobriety, to live even one more day. Herndon's poignant memoir offers a tale at once cautionary and inspirational, delightful and heartbreaking, funny yet deeply personal. From innocence to rebellion to acceptance, can a man still flourish when the spotlight dims? Are true forgiveness, redemption, and serenity even possible when the powerful say everything you achieved somehow doesn't even count? That you're not who you and everyone who matters thought you were? Find all this and more in Mark's remarkable memoir, The High Road, Memories from a Long Trip. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in paperback and ebooks, and now in the keepsake dust-jacketed hardcover edition demanded by true fans. Mark Herndon refuses to slow down, so look back, look ahead, and join him on the trip. He's taking the high road.
Mark continues to be very popular out there. I've done a couple of book signing events with him and a couple of reading events, where he takes questions from the audience or reads parts of his books, and they're always packed houses, people standing in the doorways trying to get in. That's always a lot of fun. I just read a thing today where an author had posted where she had arranged her first book signing ever, and two people showed up. And she sat there for an hour and a half embarrassed and then went out to her car and cried. And she posted this on Twitter, and a whole bunch of famous authors responded to it with their own stories about that. I mean, Stephen King, Margaret Atwood, people like that, telling about their early signings when nobody showed up and how frustrating that was. And I believe it was Margaret Atwood said that she was doing one at a big bookstore. Nobody showed up. And then people started kind of trickling in one at a time, and she later figured out it was store employees. They were having employees from other parts of the store come pretend to be customers and get books signed by her and stuff so she wouldn't feel so bad. So it's kind of nice having a name brand like that that's still selling books after 7 years. And Tom Stewart, you're on your way to doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a touching story that those big name authors connected with her on Twitter just to help her out. There's a lot of, for the bad rap that social media gets, there's a lot of endearing stories, and a social connection is a nice thing.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. So how about what's your family history like here? Married, single, kids, no kids, parents still around hanging with them?
I'm at my parents' place right now. They live on the east side of Vancouver Island, and I'm on the west side in Tofino. But just half an hour ago, I was out in the woods for the last 10 hours hunting black-tailed deer by archery. So they live in an area with a lot of deer, so I come over here once in a while, visit them, and do some hunting. But I'm single and no kids, and brother and sister. We all grew up in the geographical center of Canada in Winnipeg, Manitoba, but I migrated out west originally because I was flying float planes for a while, and there's very few places in Canada that you can fly float planes, those planes that land on the water year-round, because most of Canada freezes over, obviously, in the wintertime. But Tofino, the ocean doesn't freeze over near the shore, so I had applied out there to Tofino. Never got in because there's very few pilots on staff in the wintertime. It's a small town, but I ended up just loving the town. I was really into surfing, and I still am. So I moved out west. This was in 2008 and visited Tofino and never went back. So I've been here since, and I just love it. It's a beautiful, unique town.
So this is commercial flying, like taking groups of fishermen out to places or things like that?
That's right. I did that for 3 years. So it was, for the most part, it was based out of fishing and hunting lodges that are isolated in the north, and that's the only means of access to get in and out. So you're landing on uncontrolled, just little rivers and lakes, dropping off hunters and fishermen, like you said. I liked it. It was beautiful. You're just calling all the shots, and you can fly low over the trees, and you see the changing colors of the forest below you. It was nice. I liked it, but there's some dirty little secrets to that industry, that you really don't make much money, especially for the risks you're assuming. It is fairly dangerous. There are accidents with those smaller planes. It's not that uncommon. So I was never truly passionate about it. I just didn't have a natural calling, and it seemed like interesting work. So I did it for a few years until I transitioned into poker.
I've always wanted to do something like that, but it always seemed a little bit scary to me because, like you said, it's, you know, prone to accidents. And then you're out someplace where there's no help nearby. And if you don't have a way to call for help, boy, that could be a little bit unnerving. But you're right. The scenery out there is just fabulous. And being up in the air and seeing that would be very cool.
Yeah, there's a couple stories of bush plane flying gone wrong in the first book. Just like as you mentioned, it's pretty on point.
Oh, cool. Yeah, float planes always fascinated me. Somebody around here owns one because I see them landed out here on the lake where I live every now and then, and I get fascinated. I go out there and watch it, and I got to look up who that is and see if they offer rides or something.
Cool.
So what kind of other hobbies and interests do you have? How do you spend your time?
I got pretty fortunate with my house being oceanside, so I'm really lucky that I have a boat in the bay, and during the summer months I can paddleboard out to it, and 10 minutes away is good fishing, good salmon fishing. Pretty big into spear fishing, so I did a lot of that this year. I've done some blue water trips, some trips to Mexico for that as well, but that's a lot of fun. It sounds cliche, but under the water it feels like a new world, and the quietness and stillness of it, and never knowing what's going to come out of the reef, what's going to come around the reef. I've been doing it for a while. I still find it thrilling. So, and definitely get the spear fishing and fishing. And then Tofino, one of its biggest draws is that it's one of the only places in Canada you can surf. You can surf year round there. So surfing is such a nice activity. There's something about the water just adds to it more than, like, you know, I'll lift weights and go for runs, but the water just adds another element to it that's kind of enriching. So those are probably my big ones, but I do try to read a lot, of course. When if I'm writing, I find one of the best things to write well is to read great authors. So a simple pleasure is I've got a wood fireplace, and reading by the wood fireplace is something I've never gotten tired of and don't expect to get tired of anyway.
Bow hunting, yeah. Archery?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now is bow hunting and archery. So it's challenging because you need to get so close to the animal. It's so intimate. You have to be 30 yards away, you know, not 200 with a rifle, but the creature ends up being so close to you. And I've got yesterday there was a buck that came in 20 yards. So that's definitely within my range, but it was just a little bit too dark. And I have so much respect for these animals. I think they're interesting. I think they're beautiful, the look of them. And I just didn't want to risk that low light shot. But, it was tempting because I've been hunting for 25 days now, 10-hour days, you know, and there's snow on the ground. It's getting cold. So I don't mind if my season ends here any day now. But it was still just nice to see them. And, you know, maybe I'll get lucky tomorrow.
Cool. Beam, you want to roll another one?
Sure. And just jump down in there. There we go.
More than 6,000 shipwrecks have been recorded on the Great Lakes, but only one offers a true life adventure, like the 1926 rescue of the city of Bangor off the Keweenaw Peninsula in Upper Michigan. A fierce November storm tossed the ship with a crew of 23 and 240 new Chrysler automobiles onto a Lake Superior reef. For the first time, Shipwrecked and Rescued, Cars and Crew tells the near-tragic story of the deep snow and near-zero temperatures. Journalist and historian Larry Jorgensen's detailed research and collection of historical photos chronicles what happened, introduces the key players, and finally reveals the fate of those collector's prizes in the century since. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Shipwrecked and Rescued is available worldwide in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats.
All right. Yeah, that's selling pretty good, that one there. Excellent book. So, Tom, how long have you been writing, and when did you first realize you wanted to be a storyteller, that you had it in you, that, you know, maybe that would be a career choice?
2018 was when I started the first one, Under Big Hearted Skies. And to be honest, when I was writing them, I wasn't sure if anyone would like them. I didn't know if these were stories worth telling, if other people would find them amusing, if people would find them heartfelt, if I could move a reader with them. So when I was looking for an editor, I ended up emailing dozens of editors, just trying to find one that I vibed with. So I'd ask them some questions just to see if we could have similar interests in writers and in art. And eventually when I did find one, she reviewed them and gave me her thoughts and thought they were definitely worth sharing and that people would like them. And she turned out to be right. So, it was always, I've heard this, there's this one short story by Tobias Wolff where there's this kind of bitter prof and he says, writing has to call you, not you it. You know, I don't know that is actually true. I might not agree with that, but I could say that I've always felt like it was kind of in the back of my mind, something I wanted to try, almost like writing was kind of calling me to try it. So eventually I did, and it really feels like a fit. You know, I find it really hard to write well. I, without a doubt, 9 out of 10 things I can say that I write are not good, and 1 out of 10, you know, has some potential. So it's the discipline for me to throw out those 9 out of the other 9 and just bear down and keep polishing and work with the others until, you know, the whole thing really shines. But it's a challenging, sort of arduous process for me to have something I'm happy with and I'm satisfied with. So, the editing process is invaluable to find someone that an editor that I respect, that I trust that person's feedback. It's so useful and valuable, and it really grows me as a writer.
So who is your editor?
Her name's Margot Lapierre. She's worked on the two books that are published now, and then there's a sequel to Immortal North that will come out by February next year. And so I got that back from her a month ago, so we've done three books together now.
Now, you talked about, one out of 10, is the one that you focus on, and you throw the other nine out. I think the other nine are there. They're the reason why the second draft and the third draft and the fifth draft, the 10th draft are created. I mean, if you put the effort into it, you can polish even those. I don't usually throw stuff out. I've got stuff that, this isn't very good, but I keep them on my computer. I've got a file with, half written stuff. And there's a few times that I've actually gone back to them, found, I can do something with this now. It might be 2 years later, 3 years later, or even longer. I don't throw them out. I think rewrites and drafts, different drafts,
I see what you're saying. For me, maybe it's more on a sentence level, like maybe from out of 10 sentences, I write, then nine of them aren't exactly what I'm looking for, but I wouldn't throw out nine books. That's for sure. Not nine.
Yeah. Minutes. Okay. That's what I thought
sentence
you were saying.
Level,
you're
talking
out stories.
Yeah. No, definitely not. But there's this interview with Jerry Seinfeld being interviewed by Tim Ferriss. And I liked what he said, that during the creation process, when he's trying to make new things, he's exceptionally kind to himself, not judgmental, not critical, and just be very kind in the creative process. But then when it comes to the editing process, he's a hard ass. He really drills down, and he doesn't pull any punches or cut any corners. So I like that process of just getting out there. But when it comes to editing, you have to make those hard cuts for sure.
Yeah, I remember Anne Lamott in her book on how to be a good writer was talking about that, and she said every good writer has to start out with that first flow, that getting it out, and then working on refining it, cleaning it up, tightening it, making it better, and stuff like that. And she said every writer has to do that except one, and nobody likes her.
Yeah.
So do you set goals for yourself? Like, you just write a certain number of words each day, or write certain times of the day, or always face east, or chant, or wear your favorite underwear, or something like that? Do you have a process you follow?
for me, I like just writing by the clock, so I'll even use a stopwatch. So it's 4 hours a day, 6 days a week. I might break that up with a run outside, or a cold water dip, coffee, of course. But I like the structure of just knowing, not trying to complete, a chapter or 3,000 words or whatever, but just writing by the clock, just training creativity to show up, not writing when I'm feeling inspired, or, writing in the middle of the night or when you're happier, but no, just train creativity to show up, write like a bricklayer. I just take it seriously. I close the door, the phone's off, the internet's off, and just deep work sessions of high focus. I find out that works well for me, because there's this really nice feeling of I kind of don't even care how well it went. I just know that if I keep doing it over and over, that eventually the quality seems to show up. So there's this nice feeling of having been done with it as well. Like, when that 4 hours is up, it feels good, because it's hard. It's like a workout, it's can be challenging. So there's this reward that comes of knowing that I gave it my best effort for the day, and now it's over. So I find that works well for me.
Interesting. So, aside from the memoir, where do your story ideas come from?
For the memoir?
No, I'm saying aside from the memoir, because obviously the memoir, it's your story. But for the novel, the short story.
For the novel,
where do they come from?
For Immortal North, I knew where I wanted to set it. So I guess that was the easiest piece, was because, I've worked so much in the North, I have this memory bank of ideas, of scenes, you know, I can see the trees, I can see the lakes and the rivers and the snow, and I can hear the eagles and I can see the bears. So I wanted to use a lot of that because that's also a big aspect of where to set the novel. And then I had an idea. I wanted sort of a really intelligent villain, kind of Frankenstein type character, that something happens and all of a sudden this guy is on the loose. But what I'm finding now is that it's useful just to kind of let the subconscious have free reign. I think so much creativity is just this subconscious thing that you sit there, you know, and like I was saying, just training it to show up. And then all of a sudden your intention or my intention for I wanted the story to go is not where it's going. It's something else is trying to come to the surface. And I'm not a real spiritual person, or I don't like believe in the muse or whatever. It's just, I think the subconscious is so powerful. Ideas that matter to you that are just in the background and things you've been exposed to and read that resonate with you, whether it's on the conscious level or not. And there's a lot there. If you just kind of listen to the text, that's I'm finding is a good way to see where I want the story to go. So I normally don't know where the story is going to end, but it's just this developmental process that kind of changes on every few days, and I find it interesting, and it seems like it's working for me. And I've heard other writers say that too, so it's not like it's a novel thing, but it's interesting that people have their different processes.
So no outlining at all, entirely seat of the pants?
Well, while I'm working on it, all of a sudden I'll have an idea for a later chapter. It'll just pop into my mind, and I'll, you know, if I'm on chapter 3, and it might not even be labeled as chapters at that point in time, I'll just jump and move a note on another page. I usually have 2 Google Docs open. I don't know, Google Docs just work well for me. And I'll make a note of this is going to come later in the story, you know, and then maybe I'll have the ending when only half the book is done. And so I'll write out the idea for the ending, which might still be subject to change, but I do hop around with it a bit. But no, I don't really write a formal outline. That there's a difference though, because I'm trying to write the absolute best novel I can without a ton of time constraints. And I mean, I'm trying to write literary fiction, so maybe I do a book and a half a year. And if another author, and it's not to denigrate it at all, however a style a person wants to write and whatever topic and genre, it's great. But if a person is trying to do 3 or 4 books a year, then I can understand that outlining might make a ton of sense. And if you want that high output, you might have to have it a lot more structured. But my pursuit is just a little different.
Okay, listeners, we're talking to Tom Stewart, Canadian memoirist and novelist. If you want to talk to Tom, have a question or a comment, call in 516-453-9902. Or go on over to Twitter and post a question or comment with the hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body, and we'll see it right here while we're live on the air. So we're going to play another commercial now, and then, Tom, when we get back, we're going to ask you the big question. What is your goal in writing? What are you trying to accomplish? Why are you doing this?
Sounds good.
Submariner, 30 years of hijinks and keeping the fleet afloat. Jerry Pate's semi-autobiographical collection of 60 stories recounts his 30 years in and around the U.S. Navy submarine fleet, ranging from lighthearted to wrenching. All are poignant inside looks at naval operations rarely seen by outsiders. Topics include the real story behind the shuttle Challenger tragedy, risking his own life underwater, discovering a Soviet spy living across the street, surviving when an engine ignites, critical missions, and the everyday lives of men and women of the fleet. Compiled by author Robert G. Williscroft and proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Submariner is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Dive into Submariner for hijinks and breathtaking adventure with this poignant memoir by a true American hero.
All right. Excellent. So,
we set Tom, you up, Tom. What is the big goal? Why are you doing this?
What is the big goal in writing?
What's the big goal in writing? I want to render that human experience with its darkness, but also with its light. You know, I want to write in literary fiction because that's the world I want to play in, because that's the world I live in. I want, when someone puts the book down, to look at their hands like I might have singed them. I want them to put their hand to their chest, wondering why their ribs are sore. That if I didn't size their ticker larger, I hope I at least thumped it harder. You know, I want father to hand the book to their daughter, and daughter to hand it to their brother, and their mom asked for the book back. You know, I'm just trying to make it count, and I want people to see that he took some risk and that he left it out there, and you know, he put a lot into this craft that he values a lot. You know, there's something at stake for me with this, so I'm trying to be deserving of the continued comments that are showing up for both books. The reviews mean a lot to me. It's, you know, some writers would write just for themselves because they love it so much. It's meaningful, just the process. But I wouldn't do it if I wasn't sharing the work with others. It's that human connection, and reading that the book mattered to someone else is my validation. It's what makes me want to do it. It makes me want to write that the next day. So, you know, those are what I'm trying to do here.
So as you're writing, you're imagining readers actually reading it and reacting to it and trying to anticipate what those reactions might be?
No, actually, not that way. Like when I'm writing, you know, there's that Hemingway adage where he just says, sit there and bleed, you know, sit there and write one true sentence. So that's what I'm trying to do when I'm just sitting down to work. I'm fundamentally trying to move myself. And by doing that, you know, maybe I'll move a reader when they get it. But I know I'm not thinking of the reader. I'm not thinking of like how this is going to be portrayed. I'm just trying to like make something beautiful, make something that counts, make something truthful, show a unique aspect, either the tragedy or the joy of the human experience. Just make it count. And so I'm not really imagining the audience at that point, but when I'm done with it, like I hope people see what I'm trying to do. I hope I affect someone and that I have rendered something that matters to another person. They could say, you know, yeah, like they were moved, or they saw something beautiful here that they haven't seen before, or they'll remember this. So they read it twice, or they lent it to someone, or they, you know, those comments show up and they matter to me. So that's what I'm trying to do here.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to roll another commercial here, and then I believe we have Dr. Helen on the line. When we after the commercial, we can check in and see how she's doing.
Okie dokie.
Whether you're a parent or professional instructor, How to Teach Driving Lesson by Lesson shows how to teach fundamental driving in a logical sequence. Instill confidence in your students or family members while helping them practice their skills in a safe setting before they need them on the road. You will practice diagnosing and analyzing driving errors, especially steering errors, so you can explain and correct them before they become dangerous habits. Academy founder Kenneth Lindquist includes a wide variety of tips, such as how to avoid hugging the center line and to take proper seatbelt use seriously. This instructor's edition of How to Teach Driving and its companion Parents Edition are the perfect partners to written guides because they translate the classroom's two-dimensional concepts into three-dimensional skills. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, both editions of How to Teach Driving are found everywhere in laminate hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Whether your region requires driving instructor training and certification, or you simply want to be the best at helping beginners learn road safety, this book is the place to start.
And as I mentioned earlier, the parent version of that book is out any day now, so keep your eyes peeled. Dr. Helen, you want to take Dr. Helen?
Yeah, let's see how she's doing.
Hello, Dr. Helen. Are you there?
Hi there. I'm 5.5 months in making ambulatory progress, a lot of progress.
Still in the rehab facility, huh?
Yeah. But I want to congratulate Tom for his richly balanced life of creativity and outdoorsmanship. And I want to tell you what I'm working on, an illustrated collection called Anatomical Geography. And the first one is Silicon Valley is really that deep cleavage in a woman's chest between her cosmetic surgery breasts.
Okay.
Then I have one more, and I have to work on many others. I found the Bermuda Triangle, guys. It's that pubic place on a man's Bermuda shorts.
Oh, okay.
No, you have to. It's all pictorial. It really is a triangle.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought I'd give a little humor because I know. But I like Tom is speaks very richly. Very in depth. And it's very much appreciated. Very creative.
Well, you're sounding chipper, Dr. Helen, and we're glad to hear that you're doing so well.
Yeah, well, I'm making them laugh here.
That's a good thing.
Especially if it's on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of serious stuff that goes on here and a lot of crazy people. So what else can – it's a mini crazy world.
Take notes.
So I hope I'm enjoying your show, so let me not hold you any longer.
All right. Well, we hope you stick around and keep listening. We're about to talk to Tom about his books. We're getting into the meat of it now.
Well,
by the way, quickly, how did the music go? That's all. You were at a music festival.
Yeah, the concert went fantastic. Lots of Led Zeppelin music. That's all it was. And big Led Zeppelin fan. So, and it's the son of one of the guys from Led Zeppelin. And just a great time. Had a fun time.
By the way, I also want to mention that Tom starting writing at such a late stage and doing such a wonderful job is amazing.
Yes,
it is.
Because often we get started much earlier, you know?
Yeah.
So able to do such great work in a short period of time is amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
Tom.
All right, well, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for that, yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Dr. Helen, and stick around.
My pleasure.
And hear,
good
you
luck,
hear Tom.
Tom
talk about his books.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Before we move on, we got a couple of tweets over here. Verwayne Greenhouse says, I do the jump to a different page business. In my most active Vela, I have about a dozen things to add when I get to point G. I post these at the bottom of my manuscript so I can always see them. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then Joe Conjo, he says, Tom, I know you mentioned that you like writing literary fiction novels, but have you thought about developing a character for a series, perhaps an ongoing woodsy wilderness mystery type series?
Ooh.
Well, on that point, the next book is Immortal North 2. So this book is in a series.
All right.
Wow.
Cool. All right. Well, before we talk about the Immortal North, let's start with your memoir, Under Big-Hearted Skies. What really prompted you to feel like you needed to get all that stuff down, and tell us what it's about?
Under Big-Hearted Skies is my first book, and it's a memoir. I had worked at some unique places, a lot of remote work in northern Canada, and in those places, things have a greater chance of you're going awry, you know, so there's some life and death situations, and there's some weather extremes, and just also the characters that will work in those roles, that will take up those jobs, are usually fairly unique. So you have those two combination of factors, and to me, some of the experience I had stood out, and I was curious if other people, if they would resonate with readers as well. So that was the drive, or that was the meat for Under Big-Hearted Skies.
Is it a bit philosophical, as in, you know, what you learned from your experiences and what people can take away?
I'd say I always have that underlying greater interpretation of my world that lends itself to philosophical musing and reflection. And I think that is what tends a book closer to literary fiction, is those ideas that you try to extrapolate to greater themes. So, yeah, there's definitely some of that reflection. I'd say for sure there's some of those philosophical aspects to it.
Okay, well, that gets us to the novels then, Immortal North, and you say Immortal North 2 is coming soon. Could we get you to read a passage from Immortal North and then tell us more about what the book's about?
Sure, I'd love to. Got it right here beside me. Let me just crack it. All right, this is chapter 29, so it's over halfway through the book, but I can read this chapter without it being a spoiler, so here we go. Headlamps lit their way through the forest. Dave was thinking about the face he'd seen, A part of him wanted to believe that maybe his mind had just played a trick on him, just some weird imaginative slip, some one-off hallucination, and those things are probably more common than you think, that part told himself. About midway on their return, the trees were sparse, and above them the canopy of branches receded, showing the winter night sky. Jacob was leading, and Dave called out to him, saying, "Hold up a minute." He had switched off his headlamp and stopped trekking and stood there in the snow. Jacob turned and saw that he was shielding his eyes from the light beam he was casting, so he switched his off too. Dave said, "Look." Jacob followed his upward gaze. Above them, a patch of star-popped sky. The flurries must have been carried on high currents because they floated down from that cloudless circle and so look less like snow and more like thin shards of chipped stars, some kind of astral dust, and the light that shined in the prisms of the whirling flakes dazzled the air around them with no less brilliance than what shone from above, the essence of one a particle of the other, and it seemed they were now floating among stars falling about you. Let's just take it in a minute. Dave was staring up into it, nearly swept away by it.
Wow. Right. I'm hearing strong point of view and lyrical description, which are my favorite aspects of good literary writing. So I'm impressed. I'm excited, and I'm looking to add this to my list.
Oh, yeah. That's nice to hear. Thank you.
Now, what is the book itself about, and what will part two be about?
The Immortal North is set in the isolated woods. A father raises his boy to live in the wilds where the beauty and harshness of nature does not stop at the border of the skin until one fateful day their woodland life is violently broken. Shouldn't those guilty of such injustice be held to account?
Ooh, sounds intriguing.
Yeah, that's Immortal North. And then Immortal North 2, I had no intentions for the book to be a sequel when I finished Immortal North. But the tale just felt unfinished. It seemed there was a really humanistic element that I could develop. So it ended up flowing really quickly. I probably wrote the sequel, which is 90,000 words, and the original is 80,000 words, but I wrote it in maybe half the time compared to the first, just because I knew the characters and the setting and where the story was going to go. So that one flowed pretty quickly, and I feel really strongly about it. It's nice that my editor echoes those sentiments as well. It's nice when someone you respect also has an extremely positive thing to say about something that I've given a lot to. So I'm really looking forward to sharing it with the public, and I hope people like it.
Yeah, terrific. Okay, we're going to roll another commercial. This one's a book by Patricia A. Guthrie, and she's been sick for the last couple of weeks, and her favorite horse has been sick for the last couple of weeks, but both are better now, I'm happy to report, and she's doing great. So this is her short story collection, Eerie Charms.
Lucifer loses his day job, so he starts his own gig. A little girl's tantrum destroys her toys, but will they lash out in revenge? Can a miserable housewife find a new life for herself in a tear-stained old painting? Eerie Charms of the short story, fantasy, mystery, and horror includes a snake deciding the fate of the world, a slot machine choosing life's winners and losers, a malevolent fairy dancing men to their deaths, a couple desperate to escape a train station, the dog show judge facing death, and more great tales. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Eerie Charms is available worldwide in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Patricia A. Guthrie offers a cauldron of eerie delights that will please, delight, and yet terrify you.
Ooh.
A fine collection from a talented writer and a masterful storyteller. So get out and get your copy.
Now, Tom, we're always interested. Always interested in how our guests publish. You have your own imprint. What's the name of that?
Lucky Dollar Media.
Lucky Dollar Media. And then you have a very interesting process. You mentioned that Margot LaPierre is your editor, and we're glad to give her a shout-out because she's that good, and people need to learn about good editors out there. But you involve other people in your covers and content and whatnot. Tell us about that process.
I enjoy the cover design process because I've used this website, 99 Designs, and you can input your theme. You can suggest some elements that that would work well with you for the cover. And then all these different graphic designers that are trained in cover design will start submitting ideas, and you can pay for different tiers for different expertise of these cover designers based on how much you want to spend. And the quantity of designers will change. But I ended up working with dozens of different artists for the cover of both books. And you winnow it down until you have about a dozen that you like, you, and then you work with just a selection of those designers. And then by the end of it, it's fun because I held a poll with different friends. So I can send out a link to a couple dozen friends, and they can vote on those 10 different covers. And I can see which ones people liked and resonated with them. So you sort of get this kind of beta, A/B tested piece of artwork that is going to front your book for the rest of its lifespan. So it's cool to see that people like it and what they liked about different ones. And then you can iterate with the designers and change the color and move things around. And say you want, you know, like a drop of blood in the middle of the forest, like in the one I'm looking at right now in Immortal North. Or, you know, it's pretty fun. So that worked well.
All right. So what kind of fan reaction have you had? Has anybody come up to you and said, you know, I read your book and it changed my life, or, hey, what you wrote scarred me?
Or any reviews that mattered?
Because I live in a really small town, and I've had some nice things said by friends and family for sure. But as far as reviews that populate on Amazon and Goodreads, there's a lot, and they, like I said, they just matter so much to me, and it's not for ego, and I'm not saying it to endear myself to the listening audience. It's just that it's nice that this human connection is something that happens after you give a lot of work to something. So, yeah, there's I'm looking at some reviews right now. One was very simple, and it came up on Amazon, and it wasn't I don't think the person left their name. It just said verified purchaser, and it said this will probably be a classic.
Wow.
You know, what a short and sweet little
high praise.
Yeah, there was one that I'm looking at that said, Immortal North broke my heart, built it back together, only to shatter it again and again, and I would keep coming back for more.
Fantastic.
There's one, this last one said, I've been reading two writers I consider masters of beautiful sentences, William Gay and William Faulkner, and along came this novel unexpectedly to match them. Stewart's acrobatic sentences contain some of the best words and most heartfelt, perfectly spoken sentiments I've read. So yeah, that means a lot to me. So these are nice things to see.
Yeah, definitely. It's when it seems like somebody's really got something that you weren't sure everybody was going to get, and they jump right on it and focus on it. That really, really is reaffirming. Like, it was worth the effort to do that. And it's great that you had some of those. You got some advice
well
for
said,
other? Go ahead.
That's well said. Just how you said that was well said, because sometimes there are those little risks, you know, that you're kind of taking a risk because it's a little subtle and people might not get it. So, but it's cool when people pick up on small things. So, yeah, I like what you said there.
Definitely. So I was about to ask you, do you have some advice for other authors that are out there?
You know what? Can I read this quote that's at the start of the first book under Big Hearted Skies? That's this one. I find it's just a good orientation to remind myself. So that's why it's not a short quote, but I put it in the front of the memoir for a reason. So it's by David Foster Wallace. I'm convinced that there's something kind of timelessly vital and sacred about good writing. This thing doesn't have that much to do with talent. Talent's just an instrument. It's like having a pen that works instead of one that doesn't. It seems like the big distinction between good art and so-so art lies somewhere in the art's heart's purpose, the agenda of the consciousness behind the text. It's got something to do with love, with having the discipline to talk out of the part of yourself that can love instead of the part that just wants to be loved. Really good work probably comes out of a willingness to disclose yourself, open yourself up in spiritual and emotional ways that risk making you look banal or melodramatic or naive or unhip or sappy, and to ask the reader really to feel something, to be willing to sort of die in order to move the reader. Yeah, David Foster Wallace. I think that's such a beautiful quote, and I touch back to it every once in a while.
Great advice, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Tom, how do people find you? How can people contact you? Are you on social media? You got handles, a blog, a website, Facebook, Instagram? Where are you out there?
My website is luckydollarmedia.com, and people can – there's a free collection of short stories there. My two books, soon to be third, are on major online retailers and paperback and ebook, so Amazon and all the rest. I send out a monthly newsletter once a month that can be signed up for on my website. So, yeah, thanks.
Any Twitter, Instagram?
No, I'm not really. I'm not on social media too much.
Okay, interesting. Most authors are.
Probably at my detriment. Yeah, probably at my detriment, but.
Well, listeners, this has been Tom Stewart, Canadian memoirist and novelist. He's got Under Big Hearted Skies. His memoir is out there available right now. And his first novel, Immortal North, is out there with a sequel to that due sometime around in springtime. We're looking forward to getting that one as well. So it's been a hoot. Thanks for being on the show, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Beam and Steven. I wish you guys tremendous success in your promoting of writing. I think those efforts matter. So thanks for having me. It was nice to be here.
Yeah, we appreciate that very much. Now, next week, we're going to have Kenneth Lindquist, who wrote the driving books. You heard the commercial about that tonight. And then what's happening right before Christmas, Beam?
After that, we're having a return visit. I think this is their third time on the show. Zach and Ron Tippin from the Alterna Prague. I'll get that word right. Alterna Prague rock band, Wide Track. They've got a brand new album out. We will probably be playing some of their music and having a good time. And after that,
on December 28th, between Christmas and New Year, Beam mentioned this earlier, we're going to rerun the episode with Alabama drummer Mark Herndon and his country singer wife, Leah Seawright. That was a fun, fantastic podcast with all kinds of cool stuff happening. If you missed it the first time, you're going to want to be there. Even if you heard it the first time, you're going to want to come back. So December 28th, between Christmas and New Year's, will be a rerun of the Mark Herndon and Leah Seawright podcast. And then we just booked somebody for January 4th, Beam. Who's
January
that?
4th, B.A. Johnson, the writer of the Sassy Stories. She's going to make a return visit. She's got a brand new Sassy book coming out. So that'll be our very first new show of the new year. So tune in on January 4th for B.A. Johnson.
Yeah, and then after that, we're working on, we've got C.J. Peterson's going to be in early February, and we're looking to set a date for director and novelist George Dismukes, and we got a few other people in the hopper as well. So we've got some exciting shows coming up. Make sure you subscribe to that newsletter if you're not already getting it so you can find out who the guest is each week.
Yes.
Now, as we close out, we're going to roll one more commercial. This is for our friends who have a video podcast for authors called Meet the Author. And we're going to tell you about their show just before we roll the closing. Thanks again for being on the show, Tom Stewart. And we really look forward to hearing more about your second novel when it comes out. Let us know. We'll make sure we put it in the newspaper, and we'll try to help spread the word.
Thanks, guys.
All right. And thank you, Dr. Helen, for checking in with us, and to Joe Congell and Verwayne Greenhoe over on Twitter as well. Good night, everybody.
Yeah. Good night.
Come join the fun, make comments, ask questions. We hope to see you at Meet the Author Podcast Live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Find all the program links at indiebooksource.com.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.